You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 52. Hey everybody, welcome back to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey. Today, I've got a double header for you. I know it's been a while since I put an episode out, and I actually had both of these interviews recorded for a while, but life's been really busy, and then I got sick, so I lost my voice. It was really difficult to even record these whatever you want to call these bookends, bumpers or whatever you want to call them on the audio to get it out. So finally getting these out. And so the first interview is with Pierre Richard. He is a programmer and one of the co-hosts of the Noded podcast. So we're talking about nodes. Both of these interviews are about nodes, their importance, and then kind of the technical aspects of running one, and kind of two different perspectives here. So Pierre and his node launcher, and then Catan of Ministry of Nodes, and kind of like a full stack command line approach as well. So we'll hit Pierre's interview and then break for sponsor and then jump right back in with the interview with Catan. Pierre, welcome. Pierre's been on before. Let's see, what episode was it? Anyway, hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you, Joshua?
I guess I should stop and let you talk. Hang on, I had this pulled up earlier, like, I don't know, it was like 24 or 25 or something like that. I'll put it in the show notes. You guys can go back and listen to that. But Pierre is, you run or you created Bitcoin Axe, as well as you have a Bitcoin advisory. And then kind of what I really wanted to get into today is you created the Bitcoin node launcher.
That's right. Yeah. So, the node launcher came out of a project I was working on as part of my Lightning residency at Chain Code Labs, which was an Excel plugin that lets you get data from your Lightning node. And the advantage of having it be an Excel plugin is that non-technical users who don't know how to use the command line are able to get all of the raw data that they're looking for if they're trying to do some kind of business analysis or accounting, they're just learning about Lightning just from a intellectual curiosity point of view. Since this is Microsoft Excel, this is for Windows, and Windows does not have a very good command line, and Windows users are not accustomed to using the command line or to editing configuration files. So getting a Bitcoin and Lightning node up and running on Windows and working was non-trivial, and so to have people using the Excel plugin, it seemed kind of unrealistic. So I built the Node Launcher, which is a graphical user interface that is, it's like it sits in your system tray. It's just a little icon on the bottom right on Windows. And it's actually cross-platform. So it also works on Mac OS, and it's in the top right of your screen is where it sits. And what it does is in the background, it starts up first of all, it downloads and configures a Bitcoin node and starts it. And it downloads and configures a Lightning node and starts it. And so it takes care of all of the kind of nitty gritty configuration file issues for you. And ideally, you just download the .exe, you open it, and you are on the Lightning network and able to query it either using the Excel plugin or with the browser extension called Jewel, which is a really easy to use Lightning wallet UI.
So when you had the Excel plugin, did you still have to do all the command line stuff prior to that to get, like, you had to have an existing Bitcoin node and then an existing instance of LND, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so it's kind of a steep learning curve for someone who has to not only learn about Bighorn and Lightning, but now they have to learn about the command line and configuration files. So if we want the Lightning network to grow as quickly as it can to kind of reach its full potential, then it just seemed to me that there needed to be a little utility here that, you know, it's not a lot of software development, but it's just it's a big convenience.
So let's back up a little bit, because I'm not sure if I've ever really gone into it so much on this show, but why should users run their own node?
Yeah, so just as a practical matter for Lightning, because they had no other choice, if they wanted to use mainnet Lightning with real Bitcoin, they have to connect to a full Bitcoin node. And the easiest way to do that is to spin one up yourself. Now, going forward, there's a new light client technology called Neutrino, which means that you'll be able to use someone else's full node while maintaining pretty good privacy. So it's going to be the case that you won't have to run a full Bitcoin node anymore, even though I still would recommend doing so. And what the node launcher will do is that it will use Neutrino while your full node is syncing in the background. And then when your full node is synced, instead of using someone else's full node, you'll roll on to using your own. And the reason that's important is because you want to be using Bitcoin in kind of the most trustless manner possible. So without running your own full node, if you're using Neutrino, for example, you've got to trust the node that you're querying to an extent. Now, there are the mitigations to that from a cryptographic point of view, but you at least have to trust that it's up and running and providing the Neutrino server functionality. And then you have to trust that it'll continue to be, you know, available going forward. Otherwise, you know, you gotta disconnect and connect to someone else. And there's issues of whether you are on the right consensus. If there were to be a soft fork or a hard fork where there's a chain split, it might not immediately be obvious from the Neutrino protocol perspective. But this is something that gets debated quite a bit. And so there's different views on whether Neutrino is like a horrible idea because it is causing the death of Bitcoin full nodes, or whether, which is more my view, which is that by helping the Bitcoin network in the broader sense of the term of people using Bitcoin for economic activities, that's a huge important step. And that it also means that the software developers now have a responsibility of how to use Neutrino in a way that is not cannibalizing the usage of full nodes. So I think that using Neutrino is a way of like bootstrapping a non-custodial wallet. And then if the computer system has the resources, syncing a full node after the fact, I think that that's a pretty good combination. And that's what I'm going for with the node launcher. Even though that's not implemented yet, that's kind of the vision I have for that functionality.
Cool. So one thing that I really liked is that, because I actually did have a Bitcoin node running already, but this was how I finally was able to get on and use Lightning Network. And so what I loved is that it looked, when you start up the node launcher, it looked and saw that I already had a node, and rather than re-downloading the whole blockchain and re-verifying everything, it said, okay, we'll go from here and move forward with it.
Yeah. And what I've heard recommended is to connect with one specific full node using Neutrino with Tor. And one of the challenges with that is that Tor isn't really a first-class citizen on iOS. So I hope that Apple adds that to their operating system as kind of a native networking functionality.
Oh, really? See, I don't use Apple products very much, so I'm not aware.
Yeah, Tor is a lot easier on Android, I think.
Interesting. Okay. So let's go back though for a second, like, cause you mentioned you recommend people still running a node, and, as one half of the Noded podcast, like what are reasons that people should run their own node?
Yeah. So the first reason is to be able to verify transactions that you're receiving. And there, it's really about, you can kind of look at it in different ways. One is that you are verifying that you are actually receiving Bitcoin, because if you don't do that, and then you want to send those quote unquote Bitcoin to someone else, and they are verifying, then you're stuck, because you, if you received, you know, what you thought were Bitcoin, but were not in fact. So I think that it's really, you know, when you think about other monetary systems like the dollar, it's like taking a $100 bill and making sure that it's a real $100 bill by using a machine that does that. And so it's the same concept as that. And then if you have a gold bar, you might want to melt the gold bar down to make sure that there's no tungsten in the middle of it and that you're not getting scammed. So there's different, you know, for each monetary technology, there's different ways of verifying the authenticity of the underlying asset, because fundamentally, like, that's how you keep the asset scarce, right? Is that you're verifying that it is an authentic, you know, one of few. So that's really the main reason. And there's secondary reasons, like relating to privacy, and then also to kind of resilience. The being on the Bitcoin network yourself, connected to eight peers, is just inherently going to be more resilient than you looking up a transaction ID on a Block Explorer. And I think that, you know, yeah. So those are the benefits. And then the cost really is that people don't really know what running a full node entails. And at the extreme, they even get it confused with mining. And so they're like, oh, well, I can't afford to run a full node because the electricity consumption is so high. The reality is that the electricity consumption is de minimis. There is an initial block download. So your CPU might be at 100% for like 6 hours if you have really fast internet. But after that, it's just like running Spotify or Chrome on your computer. It's not like it's a resource hog or resource intensive. So the cost there really is about user education and people familiarizing themselves with it. And then the other cost is integrating it with how you're actually using Bitcoin. So if you're actually using Bitcoin with a hardware wallet, currently it's not very easy to integrate with your full node and to verify the transactions that are going to your hardware wallet seed are in fact Bitcoin transactions. So that's where I think that there's some really great projects that are working on bridging that gap. And so for the Bitcoin Core full node, there's a hardware wallet interface written in Python that's being developed. So we'll increasingly see easy ways. Now, there's also Electrum Personal Server that allows you to use a full node to verify your hardware wallet transactions. So that's really important. And then the nice thing about Lightning, if you're using the node launcher, is that all of your Lightning transactions are automatically being verified by your Bitcoin full node. So that right there is nice, because you don't have to think about, okay, how do I integrate this with my full node? It's already integrated for you by the Lightning developers, and it's all automated. So you're using really both the Bitcoin and the Lightning network in kind of the best way possible, in the most trustless manner possible.
Awesome. And so what made you choose LND over like C Lightning or Eclair's version?
Yeah, so the way I was kind of thinking about it is, in terms of developer adoption, I think it goes LND, C Lightning, and then async Eclair. So from a programming language perspective, I am equally unfamiliar with Go, C, and Java or Scala, which is what they respectively use. So that really didn't give any advantage to any one of them. From a cross-platform perspective, it became clear to me that LND actually is the most portable cross-platform implementation. C Lightning doesn't even work on Windows because it's written in C in kind of a low-level way that is very focused on Linux. And then it works on Mac OS because Mac OS, its underlying internals are actually Unix compatible, derived from, I think it was BSD. So That made the decision kind of easy of like LND is the most cross-platform. And the whole point of this project was to be cross-platform and to work on Windows. So it would be really counterproductive to have it, And now I hope in the future, because all three implementations are great, I hope they do become more cross-platform. And then I'll be able to, in the node launcher, you know, it'll default to LND or whatever the most kind of mature mainstream implementation is. But it will give you the option to use other implementations as well if you want to be, experimenting with other things, or you like how an implementation is specifically handling issues, or the user interfaces for that wallet are better than or fit your needs.
Yeah, very cool. I've been recently working on another machine that I have, trying to get the stack with C Lightning, and it is a little more. First of all, like anything with command line is more. Involved and not as straightforward, and there's always just little things particular to your machine that you've got to kind of work out. But yeah, it's not as intuitive for sure.
Yeah.
So who, like, obviously this kind of appeals to a mass audience. Who might, I'm trying to think of anyone that this might not really be for, and really all I can come up with at this point is people who want to use these other implementations.
Yeah, that, or if you just want to use a hosted, custodial wallet, then that this isn't really going to work for you. And there's advantages to using a hosted custodial wallet and disadvantages as well on kind of the privacy side, and the risk side of someone running away with your money. But I think that we'll see the development of more trusted third-party Lightning setups for people who, they might just be like sending one Lightning payment. They don't really want to run a Lightning node. They're not going to be using it on a continuous basis, but they just want to have a convenient way of sending a one-off payment. So there's a place and a role for those. And the node launcher is not ideal for that.
Okay. And now, because this is running LND, so any LND-based wallets this works with? I mean, obviously, like the primary one that a lot of people use is Zap, but I think there's some other LND compatible wallets. Do they work with the launcher?
Yeah, so it's an interesting landscape because Zap actually has it has LND bundled in with it, and it has a custom version of LND that is already supporting Neutrino, and also they have discussed adding a Bitcoin full node to it. So at that point, you would have a kind of the whole set up inside of Zap, and you don't even need the node launcher if you just want to use Zap. Now, there's other UIs like the Jewel browser extension, where because of being a browser extension, they don't have the ability to run a Lightning node or a Bitcoin full node inside of your browser. Now, they might in the future, or they might come up with a different solution. But in the meantime, you have to connect to a back end. And so there you can either run Zap or run the node launcher. The node launcher is compatible with kind of any user interface that wants to use the gRPC or the REST API. So there's also a Ride the Lightning, which is kind of a more advanced interface because you have to know how to set up a local JavaScript website, but it gives you functionality that isn't available in other and visibility into your data that's not available in other user interfaces.
Oh, okay. So, like, what does it have? For instance, I haven't messed with it.
Yeah. So, like, for example, if you want to change the routing fee on a specific channel, you can do that with Ride the Lightning, and that's generally not available in other. In other wallet interfaces.
Okay. I'm trying to remember. I know I tried a while back and I haven't tried since. And I know that the node launcher has put out at least one or two updates since then. But does it work with Zap for Android yet?
No. So mobile is a different ballgame. So far, of the mobile wallets that I've tried, I recommend Breeze. And what Breeze does is that it actually runs a Lightning node on your phone. So you don't have to worry about doing like port forwarding and keeping your computer on at home. So I would rather just have two Lightning wallets, one on my computer with the Node Launcher, and then one on my phone that uses, it actually uses a customized version of LND, and it uses Neutrino. And Breeze, the company that created it, so it's open source, and the company that created it, they also provide you with a channel. So they open a channel to you, and that way you have inbound capacity the moment you install the Breeze wallet on your phone.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I'd seen the name thrown around out there, but I hadn't had a chance to play around with it yet. So, and Breeze works for both iOS and Android?
I believe so. Yes, that's correct. And okay. I've only tried it on iOS. So if it's really bad on Android, let me know and I'll stop recommending it on Android.
I'm gonna look up here real quick and just double check that it's available on both.
It's Breez. And so they're just missing that last E. And to install it, you can't just go to the App Store. What you got to do is you got to go to Breeze, Breeze.technology. And that's just their URL, .technology. And then you go there and they have links to, essentially, it's like it's called Test Flight on iOS, but it's like a beta testing program so that, you can try it out there.
Yep. So it's just available if you have Android, you just go to the Google Play Store, Breeze, and it says on there early access, cool. But you can install it without having to go through any extra hoops. So, okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out and play around with that. Something I've run into with the initial block download is I ended up having to, and once I was running my own node, I ended up having to bump up my, because I don't live in a big metropolitan area, so I had to bump up my to the unlimited data plan for my internet provider. And so, what are different, I guess it depends on your computer and a number of things, like things that can be kind of the rate limiting step for the initial block download and running your own node.
Yeah, so if you have internet that's like fiber optic, 1 gigabit, then the bottleneck is going to be your hardware for sure. And I've seen it get down to like 5 or 6 hours, but that's really beyond that, you're dealing with some like exotic, high performance hardware. And if you've got like normal internet, I've heard it take as long. Well, first of all, there's people who just straight up cannot finish initial block download. But outside of that, I think that the median is probably 1 to 2 weeks to do initial block download. And it's an issue. So I think that there's opportunities for improvement there as well. I think that the main thing is going to be rolling out fiber optic internet everywhere. So that's going to be for the next decade or so until it becomes more manageable.
And is that just like there's not demand for it, or I'm not super versed in like the regulations and what it takes to get fiber optic to an area?
Yeah, I mean, it's a process, right? So we started out with dial up, where it was using copper wire, your phone, that in those tones. And then we went to like ADSL and cable. And now we're going to fiber optic. So at each step, it's, the infrastructure has to be in place where they have, installed. In the case of fiber optic, they have to install new lines. And so there's kind of a physical component there where, in your area is Google Fiber or Verizon or whoever your internet service provider is. Are they facing competitive pressure sufficient that they need to upgrade their physical infrastructure to provide you with fiber optic internet?
Ah, yeah. So if you live in an area like me where there's basically one provider who has not quite a monopoly, but essentially a monopoly on it. Obviously, it's not like government backed, but just the nature of the area. Like there's no other companies really around. There's not really a lot of pressure on them to do better or try harder or make advances.
Yeah.
Okay, so so what's next for you? I mean, I know you kind of talked about that, the things that you want to implement in the Node Launcher, but as far as, I don't remember, did we talk, it's been over a year, like what Bitcoin Axe is last time and kind of the purpose of that?
Yeah, so Bitcoin Axe is a website that allows Bitcoin Core contributors to easily see the current status of different pull requests. And the reason this is more complicated for Bitcoin than for other open source projects is that Bitcoin relies on a lot of code review. So if you want to know, for example, like how many pull requests have gotten more than two code reviews, that way you can focus your attention on that. And that's hard to do in the default GitHub UI. So you have to like click around and scroll through things and see, read the comments and all of this. So what Bitcoin Axe does is I consume or extract all of the data from GitHub about the Bitcoin GitHub repository, and I parse it and look at all of the pull request data and kind of add a metadata layer to it so that we can know what the current status of all these different pull requests is. And then on the front end, it presents it in kind of a easy to use interface of just a table. So yeah, I think that it's helpful for the project. It helps people be more productive, and the challenge is there's like 200 something pull requests open on Bitcoin Core. So if there's anything we can do to help move that along, then that's great for Bitcoin.
And is there a way, are there like low level things that people who maybe not great with programming or things like that can find and contribute to?
My recommendation for folks who are non-technical or, you know, not coders is to just use the software and provide feedback. And one way to do that is to look at fiat software or other pieces of software that you consider to be of high quality and compare it to what it looks like in Bitcoin. So then you can kind of look at what the best practices are outside of the open source ecosystem, within it, whether it's proprietary software or not, and then be able to, you know, provide mockups or some kind of explanation for, hey, this would improve the user experience, and kind of make it in line with what people expect from applications. So for example, like you might try out Venmo, and then you might try out the Breeze Lightning Wallet, and you could point out, hey, look, if we get rid of this, then it helps the user experience be more clear and easier for newbies. And so I think that's important. And there's other things too, like providing documentation for projects and translating both the UI for projects and their documentation.
And so with documentation, I guess, is there, and I'm trying to remember this because I do know how to use GitHub and use Git, so I forget. Is there a way for people without having to do pull requests and I guess you can just open an issue and make suggestions on those kind of things?
Yeah.
I answered my own question there, huh? all right, Pierre. Well, this has kind of been a good condensed information episode here. So I definitely encourage people to go out and try the Node Launcher. I'll put links in the show notes. And you really can, like, other than the initial block time, which, like we said, is going to vary depending on your hardware and your internet connection and various things, it's going to, I guess maybe we could go a little more technical, is like, what is it actually doing? So it's pulling down the chain, and then your CPU is going back and verifying every transaction from the Genesis block on.
Yeah, right? That's right. And not only every transaction, but then also every block to make sure that the chain of blocks, the blockchain matches up, and that, you know, crucially, the proof of work and in making sure that no new Bitcoin are getting created that are, you know, beyond what is normally expected.
Yeah, it'd be like going back all the way to the beginning of the use of the US dollar and verifying that every transaction that took place was a legitimate transaction and not a counterfeit transaction.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
In some ways.
I guess legitimate is kind of a broad term, but verifying that it's not a double spend.
Yeah. So because of that, it'll kind of depend. The download will kind of depend on your internet speed and things like that and space. And then also the validation will depend on your CPU. Beyond that initial block download and validation, this process of getting, like, you go to the GitHub page, you download the node launcher and you click it and it runs. And then beyond that block download and validation, the whole thing takes like less than 30 minutes to get up and running from outside of that block download, from download to like up and running with Lightning. So, and you've got several good articles that I will link that you put on Medium of kind of tutorial of walking through that and getting it set up and going with Zap.
Yeah, and then after the initial block download, you basically send Bitcoin to your on-chain wallet that is part of LND. So LND has two different parts. It has the on-chain wallet and it has the off-chain channels. And so when you say, you know, when you send the Bitcoin on chain and then you open a channel after. And so total, it takes, because you transferring the Bitcoin, you can still open a channel without any confirmations, but a channel is not considered open until it's had three confirmations. So on average, it would take you 30 minutes to have outbound capacity on Lightning.
Right. But it's definitely going to be faster than learning the command line and doing all this stuff. Is it weird to say the old fashioned way, if it's like the 2 years old or a year and a half ago, this is how you would have to do it.
I mean, it's going to continue to get easier and easier. So, hopefully, you know, people will talk about the node launcher being the old fashioned way soon.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Anything else any other advice or recommendations for the listeners out there?
No, just keep stacking sats, stay curious about, you know, what's going on the Bitcoin technical side. If you want to get involved, if you want to start learning how to code, check out Justin Moon's Biddle Bootcamp. If you already know how to code and you want to learn more about Bitcoin, check out Jimmy Song's Programming Bitcoin book, and he also has a course he teaches in person. And if you're non-technical and you want to learn more about Bitcoin, I recommend buying Grokking Bitcoin by Kalle Rosenbaum. And so that's a great book to learn Bitcoin if you're not really interested in the kind of the programming side of things, but you want to just be knowledgeable.
Very cool. I have not checked out that one. I'm working my way through the Little Bitcoin book.
Yeah, that's a great one. And then there's, for your kids, you know, go get the Bitcoin Rabbi's money book. And for the adults, you know, you could also try out the Bitcoin Standard by Saifedean. That's for people who are not bullish on Bitcoin or not bullish enough on Bitcoin. You know, they need to get straightened.
Yeah, right. Very cool. Well, thanks for your time, Pierre.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This was fun.
All right.
Bye.
All right, guys, back with another interview here, this time with Ketan. He has a great project on GitHub walking through a full, he calls it Ubuntu node box, but it's more than just running a node. It's kind of a full stack of Bitcoin and Lightning and explores and everything all on your own sovereign little box. And he also writes for the Ministry of Nodes. Ketan, welcome.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I kind of wanted to get you on here and let's talk about this, because you had some really good threads about the importance of being self-sovereign and running your own node and why this matters. Do you want to kind of go into that for a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So you'd run a node. Typically, there's three things that you need to sort of think about why you run a node. The first is to verify your incoming transactions. The second is to maintain your consensus rule set. And the third is to help serve data or blocks to others. I'll go into each of these three things in a little bit more detail. So the first one I said was verifying incoming transactions. So if I was to, pay you in the physical world with gold, if I handed you a brown bag of gold and said, hey, here's payment for the goods and services that you rendered, would you automatically just trust me in thinking that was gold, or would you at least do your own checks? So to that end, in the physical realm with gold, you would open up the bag, you would inspect it, you would, you know, sort of make sure that I haven't spray painted it yellow or something like that to make it look like gold, or try and deceive you. And then you'd obviously also weigh it. So this whole process is essentially verifying that it is gold. And so in the digital realm, what you need to do is verify that the Bitcoins that you are receiving are actually Bitcoins and not just random numbers on a screen, or someone's trying to trick you into something else or accepting something else as payment. So I'll give you an example of how that sort of plays out. Say, for example, a lot of your listeners might have a Trezor and they go into your into their, you know, web wallet, and they fire it up and they see the number of Bitcoins that they have. Now, whose node is that? Well, actually, you're connecting to Trezor's node. So what in effect that means is that Trezor, you are outsourcing that important verification function to Trezor. And so that is not ideal for sovereignty. And so that kind of leads me into the second point, which is maintaining your consensus rule set. So if you have no idea, you know, what blockchain you're on, which is very difficult to gauge truly on the web wallet that you're, or Trezor's web wallet, or even the Ledger Live software, you kind of have to, you know, trust them. And so what if one day Trezor wakes up and says, and I'm not suggesting that they will do this, but what if one day they put you onto a blockchain that has 25 million Bitcoins? And so anyone who is transacting within the Trezor's economy, so to speak, will sort of have no idea that they're actually transacting one out of a, you know, or parts of their, fractions of their Bitcoins on a 25 million, you know, blockchain, which is not really ideal. So to run your own node is to also defend your consensus rule set, saying, no, I truly believe that that the original Bitcoin with 21 million coins is the one that I wish to transact on. And that prevents you from, you know, getting withered away by inflation.
Yeah, well, and this isn't purely hypothetical. We saw this with the Bitcoin Cash fork.
That's right.
Like there were services and there were websites and wallets that were serving up Bcash numbers and saying that, you know, if you really dug into it, I think they had the BCH ticker, but they were just saying, oh, this is Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, yeah, that's right. So what you're really doing is maintaining your consensus rule sets with that. And then the final thing that I wanted to just, the last thing that you really are doing, and that's only if you open up your router to allow for this is to help serve blocks and data to other peers on the network. And so it's kind of like seeding a torrent type thing. So that's the kind of last and final, you know, node why you'd want to run a node. But first and foremost, it is a selfish act. It is a act where you are verifying for yourself whether these Bitcoins are real.
So let's kind of go back for a second. I think I would say there's a fourth one that, I mean, you did touch on it. You didn't call it its own thing, but I would say privacy is kind of a reason here, because like you said, when you're using Trezor's services or basically any service to fetch that data for you, pretty much any mobile wallet, unless you are talking back to your own node, is going out and hitting another company's block explorer. And so any data associated with that request from your phone or your computer is now tagged with those addresses that you've gone and asked for information about. And so you've potentially given them, you know, you have to trust that they're not making a list of associating IP addresses and device IDs and I don't know, geolocation X-pubs. Data. Yeah, XPub, you know, with all the XPubs and the addresses and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, it is also defending your privacy to an extent whereby you're not going into, as you said, requesting somebody else and them for that information and them logging your IP address along with your XPub, which can seriously harm your privacy. Although just a point of distinction here, they won't be able to spend your funds. So it's not a security issue. It's a privacy issue.
Right. And then, you know, this is something I was talking about to some people the other day when you went back and you were talking about the validation on the gold. I think there's probably a lot of people who don't get the difference of maybe you'd call it the asymmetric nature of being able to fully validate, because you're not just validating your own coins, but you're validating the entire Bitcoin transaction history, the entire supply. When have you ever been able to do, you know, it's difficult enough to validate your own, you know, for gold, the best way is essentially just to trust another expert and take it to them and let them validate it. And then beyond that, I mean, because the tools and not just wait, because now we've seen in the past, like, bars that are tungsten, I think it's tungsten, that are then coated in gold. So they're not pure gold. They're partially gold, partially tungsten, which has a similar weight. And so, you know, the only way to be 100% sure is then to melt it down and recast it, which is super expensive, time consuming and all these things. And so, to not only be able to validate your own for the cost of, you know, maybe $100 in hardware from your computer, you know, for a computer running this software, to be able to not only just easily validate your own Bitcoin, but also to be able to validate the entire chain of history in the economy, whether all transactions are real or fraudulent, is something we've never been able to do with any other ecosystem.
That is correct. 100% agree with you there. It is absolutely amazing that we are able to, for the first time in human history, be able to verify not only our own transactions, but the entire ecosystem. That is phenomenal and one of the key aspects of self-sovereignty.
All right, so let's kind of get into. Well, actually, you know, before we do that, we kind of skipped over your story. Like, what's your origin story here?
Yeah. So, look, I think I got introduced to Bitcoin by Stefan Levera. He's a pretty prominent podcaster at the moment, and he and I have been friends for a very, very long time. We go back to high school. And during that time, we also went to university together. And at that time, this thing called Facebook came out. And so he was starting to post some odd things. And this was before, you know, Bitcoin was kind of invented and Bitcoin was even, you know, mainstream, or, you know, it hadn't even come out. So he was posting things like, you know, central banking's a bit, it's pretty much a scam. He was posting things like, you know, all sorts of, you know, things against central banking, more on a libertarian perspective, Austrian economics, printing infinite supplies of money. He was really onto that quite quickly. And so I never paid attention to it because at university we were taught Keynesian economics and, you know, you just follow that. And that's it, it was never real to me because it was just something that it felt sort of on the fringe. And then one day Stefan linked me to the Bitcoin white paper. And it was about mid-March 2013. He linked me to it and I was like, wow, okay, if this thing can do what it says, this is pretty impressive. And then I did a little bit more research on it as well, and I just constantly read for about 2 weeks nonstop, and then I thought, you know what, this is something legit. And then I've sort of just been reading ever since, and I haven't stopped reading. I am absolutely obsessed with this technology. It's unreal.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. So, so then what kind of led you into making this, this walkthrough, this, I don't know, however you want to call it, but, it's a pretty thorough, explanation and step-by-step walkthrough of how to build this own little sovereign box.
Yeah. So I mean, Stefan kind of, you know, was saying to me that, you know, like it's probably a good thing that you can do self-sovereignty. And so I kind of just researched up this stack on my own. And at the time, what really prompted this was, I think I was never really on Twitter. Again, Stefan got me onto Twitter. I had an account, but like I never used it. But then one day I kind of just posted up my a photo of my basically a computer, and I had a list of all the software that I was running on it and basically said financial sovereignty at its best. And that kind of got a lot of attention. I think Adam Back as well was commenting there, and like there were a lot of other comments saying that, you know, how do you do this? So I thought, you know what, let's just write this up and just see if people are willing to learn. And if people are willing to learn, then go through this guide. The other thing is get yourself off Windows. I'm a big advocate of Ubuntu as well, or Linux in general. So that kind of just prompted me to sort of write this guide up and say, okay, well, if you're interested in learning more and actually being self-sovereign, that's great. You can do that. But if you wish to use another provider or another avenue of nodes, and there's plenty out there, that's fine too. But I think you start to appreciate what other companies are doing, but also understanding what trade-offs they're making as well. And I think that's really important for your own self-sovereignty. So these companies are there to assist you in making your decisions, not to impose on you. So just keep that in mind when it comes to self-sovereignty. It's not about them imposing a particular view on you. It's about you choosing. And the most self-sovereign way is to build it yourself from scratch, as much as you can. I mean, you can't really start building all the libraries up as well that, you know, make Bitcoin Core work. But at least to some extent, you've got an ability to go back if that company or that assistance fails you in some way, shape, or form in the future.
All right, cool. So let's, you know, you said you're an advocate for people getting off of Windows. Let's kind of walk through the reasons for that and why you've or actually, you know, we can start with the hardware.
Go ahead. Yes. So I was just saying, look, for me, when I first installed Windows 10 and got upgraded from whatever it was, I looked at, I just pressed the start menu and I was like, what is this? This looks like there was Candy Crush installed. I was like, what is this garbage? And then straight away I thought, you know what, this is a privacy nightmare. I need to get myself off this. So I started to go on a crusade of just weaning myself off Windows. I still run it on a virtual machine, but that's only for work. But generally, there will not be any native Windows desktops in my house at all. So, yeah, that's kind of why I was just a bit hesitant with what they were installing, where they were going. They may have brought it back, I don't know, like to a reasonable standard. But I've just, as soon as I opened it up, I was like, mate, this is just not good enough.
You can make it workable, but it is work. You know, I spend a lot of time purging all that garbage, and I probably still have things on there that I didn't get fully out. And I went through before I updated to 10 because I had seen just the all the defaults are to basically blasting all of your information to them, and so it's kind of a process to uncheck all those boxes. And even then, you know, it's like all this sovereignty and don't trust verify stuff we talk about. Like, there's no way for me to know for sure, you know, how private and secure this stuff is. So, I understand and get people who are like, you know, you should just purge all Windows machines with fire from your usage. Unfortunately, that's not my reality for some of the things I'm running, but yeah.
Yeah, well, admittedly, though, that I think Ubuntu is also a lot of work as well. It's not, you know, exactly the most intuitive, but I think over the years, it has gotten significantly better over time. So I think it's available for people to just try it out and see how it goes. I think it's worthwhile doing at this point. They have really come a long way. So give it a shot, see what you think.
All right, so let's talk about hardware requirements. What is actually necessary to run? So actually, you know what? Let's do a really broad overview, and then we'll kind of jump into each thing here. So you've got at the bottom of this stack, you're running a Bitcoin full node, and then on top of that, hang on, let me click this button here, and so you got Bitcoin Core. And then we're running a blockchain explorer on top of that locally. And then you've got Electrum personal server and Electrum wallet together. And we'll go into reasons why that in a little bit. And then you're doing C Lightning with the Spark wallet for your Lightning Network part of the stack.
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. So let's talk about hardware requirements. What's actually required? Because I hear people confuse this all the time, and they think that you've got to go buy mining hardware to run your own full node.
No, that's just not true. So for me, I found something. We have this website called OzBargain, and that's a place where you can get refurbished old desktop computers from offices who just don't need them, or their lease has expired, so now they're just flogging them off. So I got a Dell Optiplex. It was an i7, 8 gigs of RAM. This is good enough. In fact, it's probably more than enough. It's pretty quick. It's pretty snappy for all the software and the stack that you're going to run, and it costs you about $300. On top of that, I would also recommend a solid state drive for installing the actual operating system on. And then you might want to put in a 1 terabyte hard drive or a 2 terabyte hard drive to just store the blockchain on. It can be done relatively inexpensive. Now, there are projects out there that are using the Raspberry Pi. And at the moment, look, the Raspberry Pi 3, I just don't think is enough. It just doesn't have the grunt for any sort of overheads, any sort of mistakes that you're bound to make whilst you're sort of putting this thing together. So I don't really advocate the use of Raspberry Pi 3s. However, with the Raspberry Pi, they have just come out with a Raspberry Pi 4 with 4 gigs of RAM, and I think that that's enough. So I think you could probably get away with doing that. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the other options that I've found as well using the Raspberry Pi 4. And I have been using another one myself. So I'll talk a little bit about that later. But for now, yeah, the hardware requirements are fairly straightforward. And yeah, you can pick them up fairly cheap. So you don't need any sort of specialized mining equipment. It's just a normal desktop PC.
Yeah. So right now the blockchain size is about, I'm checking my own Bitcoin Explorer here, and it's, I'm getting 275.99 gigabytes. So,
yeah.
which is why you recommended the external hard drive. I know that there are people who will recommend you have a solid state drive for the blockchain itself, but also this is that, I mean, it, which would be great, but, you also have to recognize that this thing is going to continue to grow. And so, you gotta, if you're just trying to run it as tight a budget as you can, that's probably not the most cost effective way of doing it right now.
That's correct. Yeah. And that's why I'm advocating for the hard drive and the external hard drive or whatever else you want to, store it on. But yeah, I kind of tend towards a larger size because it keeps growing, and it'd be a shame having to download, another 275 or 300 gigs at one time to re-download it again. Or you could copy it over. I mean, you've got plenty of options once you've got the chain itself, but yeah.
All right. And so, the storage of the blockchain itself is there. And then, I'm kind of just saying this out loud so that I make sure that I'm thinking about these things correctly. And then what makes the difference on, because one of the biggest hangups, I guess, is the initial block download. That's kind of it's a front heavy process for validation of you've got to download the whole chain and verify through the whole history of the chain. And then from there on, it's really not that,
intensive at all.
An intensive process. So I'm trying to remember, is it your CPU, power that's making the primary difference on how fast you're validating, or is it a combination of that and RAM?
I think it's a combination. Yeah, it's a combination of the RAM and the CPU as well as the speed of the hard drive as well. I think that has also got a bit of a performance thing to it, but I'm not exactly sure. But I would suspect that it would be a CPU, RAM, and hard drive. Those are the key, I think. Yeah, if you optimize that, you're going to get a nice system. If you skimp out on any of that, then it's obviously going to affect how long it takes. But admittedly, it's going to take a long time in the initial block download anyway. So whether it's 2 days or 3 days or, 4 hours or 8 hours, I mean, it's, yeah.
Right, right. Okay, so, and then I don't know, the... Moving on to the software, we kind of covered Ubuntu.
Yep.
That's actually a pretty straightforward process for installation. If anybody's never installed Ubuntu, it gets a little more complicated if you're trying to install it parallel with Windows on the same machine. But if you're doing it on its own, you can speak to this maybe more, but, and actually I was going to say the other thing is when we were talking about Windows earlier, you'll be surprised. I've made some old machines that were essentially unusable with Windows. I've taken them and put Ubuntu on them and they seem, because it's just such a lighter system, they just work. So if you want to salvage an old machine and just use it for browsing the internet, that's actually a good way to do that anyway.
Yeah, definitely. I would also recommend you, before you go out and buy something, just take stock of what you actually have. It might actually be enough to get you through this entire node process. So just don't go out and buy. Just make a plan and see what you've got, and then go out and see if you need any further requirements. But generally, if you've got PCs and laptops lying around, then yeah, by all means, look into using them.
Okay, and so I guess this is the other part of it too. You could, I guess you. Oh no, that's more. I'm thinking. Sorry, I'm thinking Raspberry Pis. there are ways to run Ubuntu only entirely from the command line, but I don't know why you would want to do that unless you're just super hardcore or whatever. But yeah, so it's, I mean, it's a graphical interface for anyone who's never used Ubuntu or Linux. It's a pretty straightforward process. You from whatever other machine you're already using, you download, you download the, oh gosh, it's early here.
You download an ISO and
thank you, the ISO. I kept wanting to say iOS and I knew that was wrong. ISO. God. Yeah. So for anyone who hasn't thought this through, there's a like 15 or 16 hour time difference we're dealing with here. So, yeah, like you said, I don't know how Stefan does this all the time because
he must struggle with his calendars. The time difference is insane.
Okay. Anyway, so you download the ISO and then, you know, you flash that to a USB drive or I guess, do they still do like the live CD, DVD? I guess it's still a possibility.
It's a possibility.
Most machines don't.
But I would just go with the USB. Just flash a USB in, and away you go. And it'll just take you through the setup guide, and you can just install it straight onto the machine.
Yeah. Okay. And so then once that's done, then you move on and you load Bitcoin Core, which is you know, kind of the foundational block for all of this. No pun intended. And so this is what's actually doing the downloading and syncing and validating of the blockchain.
That's correct. Yeah. So, you know, Bitcoin Core is probably the most used implementation or the most popular one. So yeah, go for it. Use it.
All right. Then after that, one of the things that I have really enjoyed the most is this BTC RPC Explorer.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I've never used one of these before, and especially having it on a local machine. So it just, because you're already running your own node, you're able to go, you know, there's websites out there where you can look, you know, it's like, then you Google, oh, what's the current blockchain size? Oh, how many, you know, total transactions have there been?
You can even look up fees, what's going on with the fees situation, how busy is the blockchain? It's actually a very, very good tool to sort of gauge, you know, how big the blockchain's getting. If you keep your eye on it every periodically, you can tell how much space is being used on your computer. If you want to find out the best or the optimal transaction fee to set, then, you know, use the Explorer. It's got and of course it has the entire history of the blockchain, so you can start looking through transactions and seeing what went where. And the best part is that you're not relying on another node to serve that to you. And again, that goes to the point of privacy. So if you are constantly looking up a transaction ID on, you know, blockchain.info or blockstream.info, it could mean that your IP address is potentially being logged against that transaction, which, if you're not running a VPN, could mean, you know, that you're probably interested in that transaction or you have some sort of vested interest in it, maybe. So you can start clustering all these things together if you're not using your own Block Explorer. And BTC RPC Explorer does it really, really well. And I really like the interface and what's being used there.
Yeah. So, and there's a whole lot of stuff to this. There's even a little thing over here that says Bitcoin Fun, and you click on it, and it's got a list of interesting addresses and transactions, and then it's got a little description of like why these matter, and then references out to the side, so you can understand why this matters. So, that's a lot of fun.
That's pretty cool. And you can also check the peers who you're connected to as well, what IP addresses. But I've made my node Tor only. So there are ways you can do that. And so that means that my IP address is never really revealed, and not even my VPN IP address is revealed to anyone, it's all going through Tor. So you may wish to look into that. It's one of the settings in Bitcoin Core that you can, you know, go through Tor only.
Yeah, which I would recommend to people. Look into Tor and why it matters. If you don't know yet, it's not 100% secure by any means or private by any means. There are always ways, and
that's right.
In the same way, like with Bitcoin, where you have chain analysis companies running nodes because they're trying to be able to look into the network and know who's asking what and who's looking for what. You have governments and companies and agencies that are wanting to, you know, reveal people's IP addresses and different things like that, that are also running Tor bridges and Tor nodes. So, you know, I by no means am the king of using Tor proficiently, but it's a good starting place. So we can move on from here. And then let's see the next thing in the stack. Electrum. You want to speak to Electrum wallet and then why using Electrum personal server matters?
Yeah. Okay. So Electrum wallet has, when you first open that piece of software up, it connects you to random servers. So it's not really your own node that it's connected to. Now, I'll step back and say, look, basically, if you were to use your hardware wallet with Bitcoin Core, it's just not possible to do that yet. They are inventing or streamlining or still building hardware wallet interface. At the moment, it's command line. There's no real GUI for it, as far as I can see. But the way that you would connect your hardware wallet to your own node would be through Electrum wallet, where you can literally import in or use a hardware wallet, create a new wallet, and use the hardware wallet like a Trezor, a Ledger, or even a cold card. And you can start using your own node through that. So with the Electrum wallet, when you first open that up, it's going to have you connecting to a bunch of random servers that you have no idea who they are. So what you ideally want to do is connect to your own node. And the way that you would do that is through Electrum Personal Server, or Electrum Rust Server, or Electrum X. So there are three implementations, and they are all essentially just a bridge between your node, Electrum wallet, and it sits, and Electrum X, or Electrum Personal Server, or Electrum Rust Server, sits in between those two and provides an interface or a gateway between your node and Electrum wallet so that you don't have to connect up to other servers who are potentially destroying your privacy. So that's kind of what the main basis for Electrum wallet is. You can't really use your hardware wallet with Core. And then to use your own node, you have to use Electrum wallet. So that's, yeah, where the state of affairs is at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's important to kind of point out, is that with any of this stuff, you do have to keep up with it. And this is kind of maybe the difficult part of running this stack, is keeping up, because each one of these little pieces has its own development history, and sometimes they update things and you've got to work to make it talk to the other pieces again.
That's right. So you'll find that, you know, I've also put in a section for updating and maintaining. And I think that was lacking in a lot of guides that I've seen, where, you know, you'll install it, you'll run it, but then there won't be any way to run it on startup, and there won't be any instructions on how to maintain and update that software should it become out of date. Or as we saw with the Lightning Network, for instance, it had a huge bug in it. So you needed to update that. So it's really important that we, you know, have those instructions to update, but also understand what you're updating to. Have a quick geese of what's the What's the change log look like? What are they actually implementing? Why have they implemented it? Those sorts of things. If you're, you know, wanting to go down the path of self-sovereignty, these are the things that you just need to update and be aware of.
Yeah. And I think, I really appreciate, so for me personally, I really appreciated that you, included the parts about running it as a service, because, it quickly gets very old. You know, I did it just so I could see. Yeah. Because I was, what am I trying to say here? So the, you know, you run it in a little terminal window and then it goes off and it's spitting all this stuff out. And that terminal is essentially useless now.
That's
so
right.
You've got to open up another one.
That's
to,
right.
If you want to start up the next program or whatever. And so that's really obnoxious. And then, you know, on top of that, if, you know, purely hypothetically speaking, you have another device or appliance in your house that periodically trips the breakers and you're having to restart.
Yeah.
Not to mention any names, but maybe my printer would do that. And it, so then, you know, you're having to reboot the machine and I'm not having to remember like, okay, how many different softwares am I having to restart? Like, it's just, it's a service. It runs on startup and that's fantastic.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I wanted to aim at as well. It was just the terminal is fairly ugly, specific, more for newcomers. They don't like seeing that sort of stuff. And it's best if it's kept in the background. It's something that, you know, it takes a bit of time getting used to, but having it in the background, and starting up and it all just being there ready to go and connecting you and just using Electrum. That's all you really need to do. And it just kind of works. I think that's probably the best way of doing it.
And we should mention too, with the Electrum, the other thing is that we've seen this happen where, when there was the hack on, I say hack, I don't know if you consider it how, there's a malicious, you know, malicious messages pushed out by, nodes running the, you know, people's wallets were connecting to these unknown Electrum servers. And the Electrum servers pushed out a message saying, oh, you need to update to the new version of Electrum Wallet, which was an insecure version that gave them access to people's data and did it give them access to the private keys?
Yeah, it gave them, the people got their funds stolen,
yeah.
This is a really, really sad thing, but it is something that you need to be wary of when you're downloading any piece of software onto your computer. It is absolutely critical that you get it from the correct source. In particular, in for this instance, it's electrum.org. And also, there are instructions in there on how to verify the signature of the creator or the whoever released the code. So you just want to make sure that what you've downloaded and what you've installed is exactly what the content creator intended to be. So just be careful, especially with Trezor as well. So there are Trezor web wallet or fake ones, which, you know, pop up and say, please provide me with your seed because there's some sort of error. People go in there, give away their seed, and that's their funds stolen. So it's really, really important to make sure that you go to the correct source of places, you download the correct software, and just keep a suspicious mind, exercise skepticism at all levels. That goes past part of the don't trust, verify sort of mantra that we've got going.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on from Electrum, we've got Lightning Network. So we've got C Lightning for this one with Spark Wallet on top of that. You want to explain kind of C Lightning and why you chose it?
Yeah, so C Lightning, to be honest, it had better documentation. So that's why I used it. I was looking at LND, it wasn't like I couldn't get it to, you know, start up, and I was looking at it, but I was like, then I'd have to learn all these things about macaroons, and I was like, I'm not really familiar with that. Let's have a look at this C Lightning implementation. So I had a look on their repository. They had a really good guide on how to set it up, and it was fairly simple. So I just used C Lightning, and it's I have to admit, I've had it on for, I think, about maybe 8 months now, and I don't think it's ever gone down. Like, it's only when my computer, like, literally, when the power goes out, because, as you mentioned, the a trip in the box, in the power box, and that would be the only reason that my Lightning network would be down, or my Lightning node would be down. So it's a really rock solid, sort of implementation. It's very lightweight, and it has all these plugins that I'm also exploring. There was no other reason other than, you know, it was easy to sort of install. And also, I was familiar with all the systemd commands and all the, like, the startup commands. So I was pretty comfortable with getting that on top. And then C Lightning is also coupled with what's known as Spark Wallet. That is it's like a remote control basically for your Lightning node, but in a nice user interface. So there's a server that you run, and then you connect that, with a client. And so your client can literally be your mobile phone. They have, it supports all operating systems. So you just have to connect to that, and you can now start controlling your Lightning node without having to use the command. And you just use Spark Wallet, and you can open up channels. You can send on-chain transactions to the Lightning network node. It shows you in a nice graphical way where the status of your funds are in a nice abacus. So I really like that about it. So Spark Wallet was really good.
And I think you made a point there that I want to kind of tease out here some more. So once you get this stuff set up, you don't actually have to, I guess maybe with Electrum being the exception, most of this stuff you can set it up to where, you know, if you just really hate working with Ubuntu, you can access these things from other machines, other devices on your network.
Yeah. So, I mean, Electrum has, you know, support for all operating systems, and so does Spark Wallet. So you're more than welcome to use any sort of, yeah. And so the Ubuntu node box always sits permanently on, and it's always serving any requests from your network. If you really want to get, fancy, you can also set up a VPN server. And that way you can actually, say you're out and about and you're on your 4G mobile, you can connect back to your home network and access all the services that you've got running. But that's a more advanced feature. And
Spark Wallet has an Android app. I don't know if they have it on iOS or not, but so then would you need to use that VPN setup if you wanted to use Spark Wallet on mobile out and about?
Yeah, that's one way of doing it. There's also Tor as well. So you can use, and I've tried this actually, you can access your your Spark Wallet server over Tor. So I use Android. So you download this software called Orbot or this app called Orbot, and that connects you to Tor. And then you can, Spark Wallet will give you an address to connect to, and you can connect to that Onion address, and you can be out and about wherever you want, and access your own Spark Wallet through Tor, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Okay. So, you know, my only hang up with Lightning, with C Lightning, it's funny to me to hear you say that it was easier, and I haven't looked at the documentation on the other ones, so I haven't, I'm not countering that. It's interesting to me because C Lightning is only available for Ubuntu or for Linux distributions in you know, the, I think like LND is the, kind of the most platform agnostic or friendly or whatever, because it's available across all of them. But I guess technically you could run C Lightning on a Mac though, right?
I have not tried it, but I suspect, I'm not sure, to be honest, on that one, whether you can run it on a Mac. I should actually try that, to be honest.
Yeah, with it being Unix-based, I don't know. I don't have a Mac anymore, so I did at one point, but I don't anymore. So, anyway, the so it's not friendly to Windows anyway. So you can't.
Well, to be honest, I've noticed that a lot of software is always like Bitcoin related software is always supported through Linux first, and then they port it over to Mac or Windows. So if you, well, I prefer, like, I'm happy to do the cutting edge sort of stuff, and that's what I kind of do, just for, you know, passing time, really, just to see how implementations and how things are working. But the instructions always come for Linux first, specifically for Bitcoin related projects. So I'm always keen to test new things out, and I'm always keeping my eyes peeled for, cool projects that I can implement. And that brings me to actually, that reminds me, a cool project that I've actually seen is called, and I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called mynodebtc.com. It's a Raspberry Pi project where you essentially flash an SD card and you plug it into your Raspberry Pi, and it automatically downloads the blockchain, sets you up, puts on Electrum Rust server, and you can start using it. And it's got LND, and it's got all the, you know, Zap, and you can start connecting through to it. So I found that to be really, really worthwhile project looking into, and really user friendly. So you don't have to be a complete, genius to work out how to do it. And I thought that was a really cool project that I think I'm going to start maybe even recommending to people, friends and family, if they want to really try out the Lightning and running a node. It's really easy.
Okay, what was the address? I'm going to look it up real quick.
It's mynodebtc.com.
Okay, so they've got, order now. So it looks like they're selling their own.
Yeah, so you can sell your own, or you can buy your get your own. So I've noticed that for a Raspberry Pi 4 here in Australia, we'll set you back with a kit that'll come in at around $150. And so for $150 worth of hardware, and then you can maybe just bring in your own 1 terabyte hard drive or 2 terabyte external hard drive, other bits and pieces like an SD card, get a 16 gig SD card, and Ethernet cables, all that sort of stuff, probably will set you back maybe $200 or $300. And then there's a product key that comes with it, and that has the premium features, which will set you up with a VPN server and everything. And it's basically, that's, I think, $99. So for all up, maybe $450 Australian, you're getting a very, very good stack. That one that I can seriously say is really promising. The only downside it is to it at the moment is probably it just doesn't have enough eyes on the GitHub repository. But I think that that's probably, that will come over time.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, I mean, the only way to get more eyes on it is to tell more people about it and say, hey, look into this, and let's check out if it's legit or not. So, I'm gonna check into this. That's good to know.
This is fantastic. Look, Stefan's been on it. I'm on it. We've been testing it out for a good maybe 2 weeks or so. And I've spoken to the developer. So I'm quite happy with what he's doing, and a lot of people are impressed with it. So check it out. It's probably the easiest way to run a node without any sort of command line experience or having to go, you know. But again, keep in mind, as I said, this is something that is to assist you in performing your own due diligence. So just be aware that, you know, it's, yeah.
Very cool.
It's still new.
Yeah, yeah, sure. It's a little reckless to try it out, right?
Well, I mean, from what I've seen, it's actually looking pretty good. But again, I'm not a cybersecurity expert or anything like that. But it is actually quite an interesting project, and I have been using it, and it looks really, really promising. Especially with all the updates that he wants to do. He also wants to do like BTC Pay Server in there as well. So once that comes along, I don't know if I can recommend anything else but this. This is like this is like the holy grail of what I was looking for maybe two years ago. So yeah.
Very cool. Have you played at all with the Samurai version of Noddle?
So I will be looking into that. I'll buy one when they first come. Like I don't know if they've started shipping yet.
Okay.
No, I don't think they've shipped it yet. So I'm looking for that red box.
Yeah, the red box moves faster. Yeah,
that's right. So I'm looking forward to that, and I'll put in an order for that. So yeah, I'm interested in testing out all sorts of avenues, but this one looks to be quite relatively cheap, and you can bring your own hardware, and all you really need to do is flash an SD card, and away you go. I haven't seen anything like this, so I'm really, really impressed with this.
Yeah, very cool. All right, Ketan, what's so that's kind of your next thing that you're going to be working on. Any other projects that you're excited about?
Yes, I do have a sort of mini announcement. Okay. So, as you may know, Stefano and I started Ministry of Nodes. We're going to be hosting an online webinar. It's going to go for about, you know, a full day, 6 hours. And we will be going through things like securing your private keys, running a node, Bitcoin privacy. Those are some key aspects to sort of level people up with their knowledge. So if you're keep an eye out for the announcement, but you heard it here first on Bottom Shelf Bitcoin.
Very cool. All right. So
that's our next project. Yeah.
That's your next project. You'll be putting that out. Very cool. We will be watching for that, and I will be, I'll blast it out once you announce the dates and times and all that.
No worries.
All right, man. Well, how can people keep up with you?
You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is _K3TAN. And you can also keep up with Ministry of Nodes at Ministry of Nodes.
Very cool. All right. Thank you for your time and for walking us through this process step by step, and for creating this whole thing.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, mate. Appreciate it.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Again, I apologize for how long it's been since the last episode, but that's also kind of hypocritical because with the way things are going for me in MeetSpace right now, it's probably going to be a while before I get another episode out, and that's just the reality of it. So big thanks to Pierre and Ketan for doing these interviews. Y'all check them out and follow them on Twitter to keep up with what they're doing. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, it's @bottomshelfBTC, and you know, my DMs are open, and check out what I'm doing. Like I said, it's just I got a lot going on right now, so it's going to be a while. I've been focusing on my local meetup some and some things like that, so just bear with it. I appreciate you guys staying subscribed, and hopefully you got something out of these two interviews. All right, for Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.